then waves it in Sanderson's face.
What is this shit they're giving you, huh?
Nine asks.
This what you traded the planet for?
Sanderson peers longingly at the vials, but then weakly shoves them away.
They healed me, Sanderson explains. More than that, they made me young again.
And look at you now,
Nine grunts.
Fresh as a daisy, right?
You know, their leader has lived for centuries,
Sanderson counters, his eyes swinging wildly between me and Nine.
Of course you do. He promised us that. He promised immortality and power.
He lied, I say. Sanderson looks down at the floor.
Yes.
Pathetic, Walker says, but the venom's gone out of her. Like me, I don't think Sanderson has turned out to be the villain Walker expected. Maybe he was once the puppet master of an international conspiracy in support of Moogs, but at this point, he's been entirely chewed up and spit out by Mogadorian progress. This isn't the game-changer Walker was hoping for. I'm worried that we've wasted what precious little time we have left. Sanderson ignores Nine and Walker. For some reason, maybe because I forced him to keep on living, he appeals directly to me.
The wonders they had to offer. Can't you understand? I thought I was ushering in a golden age for humanity. How could I say no to them? To him.
And now you have to keep taking this stuff. Is that it? I ask, glancing to the syringes that I bet contain something like the unnatural genetic brew the Moogs use to grow their disposable soldiers. If you stop, you'll break down like one of them.
Old enough to turn to dust anyway,
Nine grumbles.
It's been 2 days, and look at me.
Sanderson waves a hand at himself, at his body that looks like a slug with salt poured on it.
They used me, kept giving me treatments in exchange for favors, but you freed me. Now I can finally die.
Nine throws up his hands and looks at me.
Dude, screw this! This guy's a lost cause! We need to figure something else out!
A sense of desperation begins to sink in now that Walker's lead on the Secretary of Defense has turned up only a broken old man and gotten us no closer to thwarting the imminent Mogadorian invasion. But I'm not willing to give up just yet. This lump sitting in front of me used to be a powerful man. Hell, the Moogs had a protection detail on him. So, he still is. There has to be a way to fix him, to make him willing to fight. I need him to see the light. Some combination of desperation and intuition causes me to turn on my lumen. I don't crank it up to fire level. Instead, I produce just enough juice so that a beam of pure light shoots from my hand. Sanderson's eyes widen, and he inches back on the bed away from me. I already told you. I'm not going to hurt you, I say as I lean in towards him. I shine my lumen on the palsied, saggy part of his face, wanting to get a good look at what I'm dealing with. The skin is grayed and almost dead-looking, fine, ash-colored veins running through it. The dark particles under Sanderson's skin actually seem to float away from my lumen, almost like they're trying to burrow deeper. I can heal this, I say resolutely. I'm not sure if it's actually true, but I have to try.
You can fix what they did?
Sanderson asks, a note of hope in his gravelly voice. I can make you like you were, I reply. Not better, in the way they promised, not younger, just as you should be.
Old people get old, Nine puts in. You gotta deal with it.
Sanderson looks at me skeptically. I must sound just like the Mogadorians did years ago, when they first convinced him to join their side.
What do you want in exchange?
He asks, like a high price is a foregone conclusion. Nothing, I reply. You can try killing yourself again for all I care. Or maybe you can find what's left of your conscience and do what's right. It'll be up to you. And with that, I press my palm against the side of Sanderson's face. Sanderson shudders as the warm, healing energy of my legacy passes into him. Normally, when using my healing powers, I get a sensation that the injury is knitting itself back together, of cells rearranging themselves beneath my fingertips. With Sanderson, it feels as if a force is pushing back against my legacy, as if there are dark, cellular pits into which my healing light plunges down and gutters out. I still feel Sanderson healing, but it's slow going, and I have to concentrate much harder than usual. At one point, something actually sizzles and pops beneath his skin, one of his discolored veins burning up. Sanderson flinches away from me. Are you hurt? I ask, short of breath, my hand still poised next to his face. He hesitates.
No. No. It actually feels better. Somehow cleaner. Keep going.
I keep going. I can feel the Mogadorian sludge burrowing deeper into Sanderson, retreating from my legacy. I intensify my healing, chasing it through his veins. I find that I'm squinting from the exertion, and a cold sweat dampens my back. I'm so focused on beating back the darkness, I detect inside Sanderson that I must lose track of time or enter some kind of trance state. When I'm finished at last, I stumble backwards, my legs wobbly, and run right into Sam. I wasn't even aware he'd come upstairs. He's holding out a phone. Did he steal it from that bystander we knocked over? And recording my healing of Sanderson. He stops when I bump into him, and, for a moment, Sam is the only thing holding me up.
That was awesome, Sam says. You were, like, glowing. Are you okay?
I draw myself up with some effort, not wanting to show any signs of weakness in front of Walker or Sanderson, even though I feel drained. Yeah, I'm good. I catch Walker staring at me with that same look of awe her driver had after I healed his neck. Sanderson, still sitting in front of me, looks close to tears. The black spider webs that crisscrossed beneath his skin have disappeared. His face no longer droops. His muscles aren't atrophied. He's still an old man, deep-set wrinkles lining his face, but he looks like a real old man, not one who slowly had the life drained out of him. He looks human.
Thank you,
Sanderson says to me, his words barely above a whisper. Nine looks at me, checking to see how I'm holding up, then turns to Sanderson and snorts derisively.
It's all for nothing, Grandpa, if you let those pasty-faced asshats land on Earth.
I am ashamed of what I've done, what I became, Sanderson says, his gaze pleading and confused. But I don't understand what you expect me to do. Let them? How can I stop them?
We don't expect you to stop them, I say. Just slow them down. You need to rally people against them. When you make your speech tomorrow at the UN, you need to make it clear that the Mogadorian fleet can't be allowed to land on Earth. Sanderson stares at me, confused, then slowly swivels his gaze towards Walker.
Is that what your mole told you? Is that what you think will be happening tomorrow?
I know what's happening, Walker replies, no less caustic now that Sanderson seems to be coming around to our side. You and the other leaders who the Moogs have bought off will get up on stage and convince the world we should coexist peacefully.
Which is really just code for surrender, Nine adds.
Yes, that's planned for tomorrow, Sanderson says with a dark, hopeless laugh. But you've got the order confused. You think I give some speech and then their beloved leader lands his ships? You think he cares about the slow-turning wheels of human politics? He's not waiting for permission. The UN will convene to save lives, to calm a frightened population, because a military resistance is doomed against that. Sanderson gestures wildly through the door, at the television still buzzing in the other room. Slowly we each turn, leaving Sanderson's bedroom for the penthouse living room, drawn in by the ashen face of a cable news anchor. She stumbles over her words as she tries to explain the unidentified flying objects manifesting in the air over dozens of major cities. The reception goes in and out, the bursts of static getting more and more frequent as something interferes with the signal.
Reports coming in that the ships have been sighted overseas as well, in places like London, Paris, and Shanghai,
the newscaster says, eyes wide as she reads from her teleprompter.
If you're just joining us, something literally out of this world is happening. As ships of alien origin have appeared over Los Angeles, Washington...
It's happening, Sam says, stunned, looking at me for some kind of guidance. The warships are coming down. They're making their move. I don't know what to tell him. Grainy footage of a massive Mogadorian warship sliding out of the clouds in the sky over Los Angeles appears on screen. It's everything I dreaded coming to pass. The Mogadorian fleet is gliding slowly towards a woefully unprepared Earth. It's Lorien all over again.
I tried to tell you, Sanderson calls to us. It's already too late. They've already won. All that's left is surrender.
Chapter 22. I'm done doing what they tell me, what any of them tell me. My eyes snap open. I'd been in a deep sleep, one that I didn't think would be possible in my giant Mogadorian bed with its strange, slippery sheets. I'm becoming uncomfortably adjusted to life aboard the Anubis. I thought I heard a voice in my sleep, but maybe it was just my imagination, or the remnant of some dream. Not taking any chances, I stay very still and keep my breathing even, like I'm still asleep. If there is an intruder, I don't want them to know I'm awake. After a few seconds of silence, filled only by the ever-present hum of the warship's engines, a voice resumes speaking. One side drops us on this strange planet, and basically forces us to fight for our lives. The other side, they talk about peace through progress, but that's all fancy talk for killing anyone who stands in their way. It's Five. He's in my room somewhere. I can't locate him in the near darkness. I can only hear his mumbled, under-the-breath rambling. I'm not even sure if he's talking to me. They all just wanted to use us, Five hisses, but I'm not going to let them. I'm not going to fight in their stupid war. He shifts then, and I can finally make out Five's outline. He's sitting on the edge of my bed, his skin the dark, slick texture of my sheets. He blends right into my covers, and it must be because he's touching them, using his externa. That means his legacies are back. It also means that he's seriously creeping me out, like a monster came crawling out from under my bed. I know you're awake, Five says to me without turning his head. The ship is descending. We aren't in orbit anymore. If you want to go, now is the time. I scoot up in bed, keeping the covers close. For a second, I consider making Five powerless again by charging the sheets with my Draenen. But what good would that do? I decide not to attack him. For now. I thought you were on their side, I say. Why would you help me? I'm not on anybody's side. I'm done with this whole thing. What do you mean, done? For a while, after my Saipan died, I was alone. It wasn't so bad. I'd like to go back to that, Five says. You know how many little islands there are in the oceans? I'm going to pick one out and stay there until this is over. I don't give a shit who wins, so long as they stay far away from me. That's cowardly, I reply, shaking my head. I'm not going to some deserted island with you. Five snorts. I didn't invite you, Ella. I'm getting off the ship, and I thought you might want to come along. That's as far as we go. I consider the possibility that this could be some kind of test, orchestrated by Cetricus Ra. But remembering the way Five acted earlier, I decide to take my chances that he's for real. I hop out of bed and pull on my thin-soled Mogadorian slippers. Okay, what's your plan? Five stands up, and his skin reverts to normal. As the automatic lights come on in my room, I can finally see his face. He's changed the bandage over his eye so that it isn't crusty with blood anymore, but he still hasn't gotten it healed. His remaining eye twinkles like he's excited to get into some trouble. Seeing him makes me second-guess my decision to join forces. I'm going to open up one of the airlocks and jump out, Five says, illustrating his brilliant plan. That's nice for you. You can fly. What am I supposed to do? Five reaches into his back pocket and casually tosses me a round object. I catch the stone in my hands and cradle it. I recognize it as one of the objects from John's chest. Sitharis stone, Five explains. I borrowed it from our friends. You stole it, he shrugs. I charged it with my flight legacy. Use it to fly off and save the planet. I hide the stone inside my dress, then look up at Five. So that's it? You think we're just going to walk off this ship? Five raises an eyebrow at me. I notice that he's not wearing any shoes or socks, probably so his bare feet are in constant contact with the metal paneling of the Anubis. Also, attached to his forearm is some kind of contraption that looks like it might be a weapon.
They won't be able to stop me, Five says, a dark confidence in his voice.
It isn't exactly inspiring, but it's the best hope I've got. Okay, lead the way. The door to my room slides open for Five. He pokes his head out, checking to see that the coast is clear. When he's satisfied, Five hustles into the hallway, motioning for me to follow. We navigate the labyrinthine halls of the Anubis at a brisk walk.
Just act normal, Five tells me, keeping his voice low. He's got scouts watching us always, but they're also afraid of us. You, in particular, are supposed to be treated like royalty. They won't interfere if we don't look suspicious. And even if they do think something's wrong, by the time one of them actually works up the guts to tell beloved leader, we'll be gone.
He's talking a lot. That tells me that he's nervous. Without thinking about it, because if I actually thought about it, I might get too repulsed, I reach out and take Five's hand. We're just a newly betrothed couple, getting to know each other, I say. Enjoying a nice walk through the cozy halls of a massive warship. Five's hand is sweaty and cold. He tries to jerk away from me,
his initial instinct not to be touched. But after a moment, he called.